Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome back to The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your co-host on the East Coast for episode 421, along with my pal Sam Malai out there in sunny California. What's the weather like out there in Hollywood?
Not too bad. We're sending our prayers to all of our colleagues, the Southern East Side. Hope everything turns out safely and okay for everybody.
Yeah.
All right. So today, Neil, we have a super interesting and fun topic, which is...
Yeah, I like this one.
Yeah, this one's pretty cool. And know what? I feel like it's a topic that not that we will talk about. The five toughest decisions in law, right? As law firm owners and lawyers, we have to make some tough decisions. So we're going to bring up the top five that we see, give you some good pointers about how to navigate these decisions, and hopefully give you some frameworks to make these decisions quickly. And I'll start off with the best one, which is where to spend money for marketing. Neil, there isn't a lawyer who doesn't have this decision to make. So talk it out.
And it's usually the first one they're confronted by.
Correct. And it's an ongoing thing. So here's some frameworks that I'll share with everybody. Number one is things change all the time. So what may have worked a year ago, 6 months ago, 3 months ago, may not be the case now. And it always pays to be in networking and communities where this is discussed and shared with your colleagues. Hey, for my practice type, what's working best right now? And when there's a community who feels safe to share that information, that's where you want to be. And that's where we are inside a lawyer club, where we share that freely. We don't see each other as competition. We just see each other as a win-win. And the more we share, the more we get back. And that's something also that I try to share in our mastermind calls. Get very practical. What do you do? Okay, you do this. You do estate planning. Well, first level is, let's just say we need to do Google LSA. That's level one. So let's accept that, you know, things change. And it also pays to know where the change is. The other framework is what I call the traffic ladder. The traffic ladder, traffic in marketing terms, is just where your leads are coming from. When it comes to legal marketing, the best source of clients comes from two sources. Very simple, Neil. It's either going to come from Google or Facebook. Simple as that. 80% of marketing will be one of those two. Okay? I didn't mention SEO. I didn't mention content marketing or social media or any of that other stuff. Those other kind of stuff that I mentioned may get you 5 clients, maybe 10 if you're doing it fantastically and you're killing it. But we're looking for scalable growth in everything that we do. So number one in this traffic ladder that I see that generally applies for most practice types, Neil, is number one is Google LSA, Google local search ads, I believe, service ads for search ads. That's where it's at because it's also the easiest. This is Google's way of making it easy for anybody to go open up an account and just give a budget and say, hey, Mr. Google, I have $3,000 to spend this month. How many calls could you get me? It basically cuts out the media buyer or the person who's going to basically set up your ads account for you. And it gives you direct calls. So there's no landing page. There's no funnel. There's none of that. You just get incoming calls from prospects who are Googling, usually on their phone. And you get those calls. That is fundamental layer one of marketing. Layer two is going to be Google Ads. That's been the primary kind of main way that most people have generated clients in the past 10, 15 years, if not longer. Also fundamental. You need to get that down. Google Ads campaigns, that comes down to having a good media buyer. We make those introductions for you. We also have some people in-house that could do that, that could set this up for you. Fundamental. Pretty simple. Somebody who's built a campaign specifically for your practice type goes and duplicates the exact campaign for you in your city or state with an optimized landing page. And then somebody who manages the negative keywords, making adjustments, keeping up with Google's updates when it comes to performance max, which are these are different types of campaigns that Google releases. And basically, it's just staying on top of the trends that Google releases. That's number two. Number three, Google My Business. It's free. Basically, all you have to do is create a profile, fill it out, upload some pictures, and get as many Google reviews as possible. We've discussed this in detail before. fundamental. It's the easiest, lowest hanging fruit that you got to do. And then number four is meta ads, Facebook ads, Instagram ads. That kills it. It does really, really well. However, the nuance is it's a much higher, steeper learning curve. So you really got to know what you're doing. But if you know what you're doing, it has a much bigger upside by a factor of 10x if you know what you're doing when it comes to meta. And that's where we thrive at. It's something that I lean towards to myself and our team. And that's something that we set up for a lot of law firms. So if you don't know where to spend money on marketing, that is the short gist of it for you. Google LSA, Google Ads, Google My Business, and Facebook Ads is where it's at.
Yeah. And I think one of the things we need to caution ourselves against is when you go hang out networking events and, you know, other types of communities, and you ask that question, you know, what's working, and try and get some feedback for what others are doing, you know, take it all with a grain of salt as well. Because, you know, if I go to a bar association meeting and, you know, I talk to five different attorneys and I say, oh, you know, referrals, you know, just do the good work and the referrals will come. That's really not a good source for me to emulate, because that's really not scalable. And that's kind of old thinking these days. You have to look at the systems that Sam is mentioning that have a far greater reach, you know, orders of magnitude, better penetration into potential markets that you could never get just with referrals. Don't get me wrong, referrals are great, but that's not a way to scale your practice. So where you spend your money, you need to spend your money on systems, on frameworks, as Sam was saying, that can penetrate on a large scale potential lead sources.
Yeah, totally. It's not something to kind of depend on. If you definitely want to build a referral system, great. You want to maximize on it. You know, if something's working for you, go get more of those people who are referring you. Just go triple down on it and get more of those. But it's not something to rely on, because as Neil shared, it's not really scalable and it's not dependable either. I also want to give some honorable mentions to TikTok ads and YouTube ads. But again, you know, think of it as a ladder. You want to get down the ladder, start off with the easiest ones. But also there's a lot of opportunity when it comes to TikTok ads and YouTube ads. And then I also want to make a special shout out for things that you shouldn't do. Don't hire a social media company. You don't, you know, just by posting on social media, that doesn't get you clients. It's good for branding purposes. You know, people that are looking to hire you, yes, they will look you up on social media. Yes, you do want to have a foundational base of some, you know, activity going on there, but don't rely on it as your way of getting clients. If you happen to get some clients from a couple per month, amazing, but it's not something that I'm going to invest too much time and too much focus on. But essentially, it just comes down to ads is the way to go. Let's go to number two. The second tough decision you can make in law is who to hire. Neil, what's your take on this?
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit last week when we were talking about being too slow to hire. Concurrent with that is who to hire. And it's really crucial to hire people that can share your vision and be a part of your team. You know, way back when, centuries ago, when I was in the tech industry, we company paid for a consultant to come out and review our management practices. And since I was a lead manager on a big software project, they were reviewing my performance and my approach to management. And I'll never forget that in the debrief to my bosses, they described me as a country club manager. And I was taken aback by that at first. And then I realized, no, you know, I'm leaning into that, because what it meant for me is I want to enjoy the company of the people that I hire. I want them to be part of the team, of the family. If I can't feel comfortable with them, then I don't really care what technical skills they have, because I'm not going to enjoy working with them. And so I want to hire people who do things, who are open to growth, and who want to share in the vision, and with whom I'm going to enjoy spending time with, because otherwise, why bother?
Yeah, and hiring is just one of those things where it's just more of an art than science, right? It's not a perfect thing that you're just going to get it right. What we've seen is, you know, you're going to probably be right 50% of the time and be wrong 50% of the time. So you take your clues, and again, we've had episodes about this before, and we went this in detail. It's some intangible kind of signs and some tangible signs. You know, you want to see actual proof of what they're talking about. And also when it comes to intangibles, like look at their surrounding. Where are they interviewing from? What does their room look like? All that kind of stuff. How are they dressed? You know, do they take care of themselves? Those are like little clues that gets you closer to making a better decision. And then as we shared, the winning formula that I can kind of distill it down to, Neil, at least right now, the, you know, based on my most recent experience, is hire doers and not talkers. And we've talked about this before, how to spot the talkers versus the doers. They usually, the talkers are always talking about the past of things that they've done, or they make a lot of promises of things that they will do in the future, or they overextend their talking and they talk more. So if you noticed, all those things have a time aspect, right? And they talk about the stuff in the past, or they make a lot of promises in the future, or they even extend the time. So that's kind of a little clues if you notice that. But doers are the opposite of that. They don't talk so much about the past. They provide proof of what they've done. They don't talk too much about what they'll do. They just do. And number three is the meetings are usually shorter. You know, I could really easily differentiate in our team who's a talker, who's a doer. In our, with our doers, we have super short meetings, and those are like my meetings that I actually look forward to, because we're just like, it's like meeting of the minds, you know, and it feels so good to just meet. We just get our strategy down. You know what you got to do. I know what my role is. I know you know what your role is. Go get it. And we just get clear on what we got to both got to do. And we just update each other through Slack, and we're like just so aligned. It just so feels so good, Neil, to work with those types of people.
Do you put a lot of stock in personality profile systems for helping you make hiring decisions?
I personally don't at this level that I'm at, because I'm just right now, I'm just like quick, just trying to make quick things. I don't have time to go do that. Yeah, will it be helpful to have somebody in our team who's kind of our recruiter who does that? By all means, yes. But there's one tool that I'll share, and I was actually discussing this with my partner yesterday. Is there's a one of our colleagues, really young, I think he's like 26 years old. He went and created an AI tool that screens and recruits talent and uses AI. And the way this is actually pretty genius. So the way this works is, imagine you built this AI avatar and you define what this, you know, what role that you're looking to hire for. And this AI avatar, there's a link that's sent to prospects of candidates that are looking to potentially be hired by your law firm or your company. And this AI avatar basically gets on camera with the candidate and starts asking a series of screening questions. And the candidate answers those questions. And those answers are transcribed and analyzed by AI and compared with other candidates to give it a score of how they performed when it comes to technical skills or their confidence or whatever you could, all these probably algorithm that they built out. It's genius. The tool is called Micro One, the number one, MICRO1.AI. They recently raised like 20 X amount, you know, a good amount of millions of dollars. I think they're worth like $60 million by this 26-year-old kid named Ali. It's amazing. It's genius. And my partner shared that they recently started using it and it blew their recruiters out of the water, because it's able to perform better than a human, because it's able to psychoanalyze, you know, what they're saying, all that stuff, and it's able to compare it and all the stuff. So it's pretty genius. So if I were to ever use a tool, Neil, that you're mentioning, it would definitely be this.
Yeah. That's interesting. I'll peek at that.
Yeah.
Micro1.AI.
Yeah. Genius. I love it. And I knew he was one of those kids that I met like 4 years ago. He was like 2020. I think he just graduated from Berkeley and he's trying to figure it out. And he joined us. And I'm like, this kid is going to be a unicorn. This is a unicorn. Just the way his traits and his tenacity. I'm like, he's going to make it. And lo and behold, it's only been like 3-4 years. He's already has like, he's worth already $60 million. Amazing. Number three, one of the toughest decisions we have to make in our law firm, Neil, is how to incentivize your law firm employees.
Yeah, right. That's always another goes hand in hand with who to hire, how to incentivize them.
Yeah, because we want performance. And what we've seen is there's nothing. Well, one of the many things that drives performance is incentives. Our framework of TGI, everybody on your team needs to be tracked based on the main KPI that their role is supposed to accomplish. Number two, there should be everybody should have clear goals, ideally one metric for what they need to accomplish per month. And number three is ideally incentivized to get them towards that goal. And we've had episodes about this before. Again, I always have to address, you know, talk to an ethics lawyer in your state to make sure you comply with everything. Avoid specific client incentives. You know, don't say if you sign up this client, I'll give you the X amount. However, there are ways around it, which is to create team-based bonuses. So try to bonus the entire intake team. Avoid percentages of specific cases and try to create tiers. Just one example is if you sign up X number of clients, then it'll be X amount. If you sign up a higher tier of number of clients per month, X amount. And if you sign up other, you know, another tier of clients, X amount. Again, please make sure this checks out with your state bar rules, but this works pretty well. And it's a good way to kind of be able to get good performance from your team.
Yeah, I think there's always a tendency on our parts to think that the way to success and to scalability is to get the most for the bang for the least buck. And that is almost always a recipe for failure. Okay. You need to be able to come to grips with the idea that as your team succeeds, you succeed. And when you succeed, you share the wealth. And because without that, you lose the confidence and the trust factor in your team, and you're not going to get the performance levels that you want. So right. I think that framework TGI, I think is perfect. It encapsulates the key points very succinctly. And that incentive program, as you said, if it's team-based, I think you're okay. I will tell you that if it's something that passes muster in California, you're probably have a good chance that it's going to be okay with your bar association. So, because you know, you guys are pretty tough with that kind of thing.
And you could also incentivize based on other key metrics.
Factors, yeah.
Right. So it doesn't have to be based on clients. So Neil, one big kind of thing that drives growth is Google reviews, right? The more Google reviews you get, the more likely you are to show up in Google local pack and the more clients calls and clients you get. So maybe incentivize towards that. Hey, Mr. Yeah. Bob, you know, right now we're at 64 Google reviews. If we get to 85 Google reviews by the end of this month, you know, you get X.
The whole team.
The whole team. Yeah. We all go to London, you know, all that stuff. So look to see, you know, what are the kind of the KPIs that you can incentivize towards.
And Sam, how do you feel about revealing details about the income level of the firm or the revenue level of the firm as being a measure?
No, red flag. It's forbidden things to discuss, share with the world, all that stuff. And especially with your team. No, you want to hide that. That should be one of your secret sauces.
Just wanted to bring that out.
Yeah. Great point. And I've seen a bunch of lawyers do that. I'm like, oh, yo, you're entering some, you know, dangerous territories for multiple reasons.
For multiple
reasons.
And, you know, I see that a lot with personal injury attorneys. I don't know about what your experience is.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's always a good idea.
No, multiple reasons. We'll leave that to your imagination, whatever that means. Number four, Neil, I know you feel strong about this. One of the tough decisions we have to make is managing work-life balance versus law firm growth. Neil, I'm going to let you take this away.
Yeah, so this means different things to different people. And, you know, I'm a real firm advocate that work-life balance has to be the driving factor. Because without that, you have burnout, you have exhaustion, you have anxiety, you have health issues. There has to be a work-life balance. And how do you create it? And how do you manage that against your desires to have your firm grow? And I will tell you that, look, it's going to be different for everybody. My desires about work-life balance are going to be different than yours, say. And I'm going to suggest, in part, there are factors that control that. You know, I'm at a point in my life, age-wise, where, yeah, I want growth, but I don't want exponential, explosive growth, because I'm at that point where I'm not going to be able to take advantage of that. And so, for me, it makes the work-life balance a little more achievable, because I'm not looking for the same thing. So you have to figure out where you are on that spectrum and manage accordingly. I've talked about setting priorities in the past and rules about what you're willing to accept and not accept in terms of your work-life balance. I think you really have to constantly look at those, reflect upon them, and adjust them as necessary. And also recognize, in some ways, my work-life balance is seasonal, right? I'm more willing to do some things in the winter than I am in the summer. And so I need to account for that. So there's a lot of considerations that go into determining, you know, just where that balance point lies. And, you know, don't compare yourself to others, because, you know, just because somebody else is working 3 days a week and experiencing growth that's more than yours, it doesn't really goes along with what we talked about last week about being a follower, just following other people. Figure it out for yourself what your ideal work-life balance is, and then manage your growth accordingly.
Neil, spot on, my friend. You hit all the main principles, and you're so right. And that comes from your maturity and experience in this, right? So you've seen it all, heard it all, you know, seen the people who put, you know.
I've failed in most of it for many years. So I honestly can say my work-life balance didn't start to get acceptable until, you know, recently. So I've had to work at it.
Amazing. And, you know, these realizations come to you as you grow and you get more experience. But the goal is to get to this point as soon as possible. Luckily, these realizations for me went off early in my career. You know, reading Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek book was really pivotal for me to get in the right frame of mindset. Like, what do I want out of life? Is the goal to just make more money, work long hours? Hell no. That's not my entire goal at all. I want to be smart. I'm going to work smart. I want to be well balanced when it comes to my family. I'm going to be ideally as much connected to my own community as I can. I want to contribute to my community. I want to teach my community. You know, I want to do all those things. And I can't do all those things if I'm just focused completely on work. And it's obviously, it's ongoing work. It's not just something you just do and that's it. No, you're always constantly, day in, day out, have to, you know, fight that challenge. For me, let me share my kind of framework. Number one is to set clear goals and really introspect and ask yourself, what's your ultimate goal in life? Is it just to make money? Okay, be it so, if that's the case. Or is it to be more well-balanced? Is it to be a family man? Is it to be focused on your health? Whatever that is, you know, everybody has different objectives by all means, you know. But whatever it is, you got to be clear on what your main priorities are. And you got to make those rules that nothing trumps, just say, for example, nothing trumps my family time. Okay. And what those things are. Number two is you can always do more. However, it's all about balance, right? If I really, really wanted to blow things out of the water, Neil, I could work 16 hours a day, create, launch multiple campaigns a day, hire 100 people a month, and do all these things. But it's like, what for? And it just comes down to balance. And my mindset is always sustainable. Everything has to be sustainable. Yes, you know, you could, you know, take moves and take like sprints and do things. But if it's not sustainable, it's like, okay, to what end? So instead of focusing, as Neil, as you shared, you know, rapid growth, maybe just consider building long-term sustainable growth, that where you're building your equity and your it's kind of whatever efforts that you're putting in adds on to your past efforts, and that leads to a sustainable, long-term, kind of scalable growth. These are all kind of fine mindset, the kind of things, but again, it starts with you. You got to have this deep conversation and this serious conversation with yourself. Once you're clear on that, then you let your decisions that you make on a daily basis, you know, follow these guidelines.
Yeah, and listen to yourself. You know, I recall saying at one point, man, it's 3:30 on a Friday afternoon. Why the hell am I having a client meeting? Okay. And instead of just complaining about it, say, well, you know what? I'm not going to do meetings after noon at 12 o'clock. No, clearly that's the universe telling me set up your rule and work from there, refine it. And then pretty soon I'm not doing any meetings on Friday or Monday. I want that flexibility. You just grow from there.
I love it. All right, let's go to challenge number five.
Number five
is when to be aggressive or passive with your employees. Everybody is, a lot of people are probably dealing with this, right? You know when to push or when to be hands off, completely passive. You know, you just do whatever you want you got to do to do it. You know, I think for me, Neil, this comes down to how to be a good parent. You got to know when to push and when to lay back. And it's a very fine line that you have to work with. You know, you got to pick your battles. You know, don't be so hard-headed. Don't react. And you know, all those things, those principles that, you know, as a good parent that you want to do to your kid. It's just so funny that, you know, it comes down to the same kind of principles with your peers when it comes to your own team. Neil, what are your thoughts about this?
So I cut my teeth as an employer way back when I managed a union shop. Okay. All my employees were unionized. And so there were a lot of rules built around that. And so I learned how to operate within that kind of construct. And then for many, many years, like I said, law was something that I came to late in life. For many years, I owned and operated a martial arts studio. And so your analogy regarding being a parent, for me, very similar to being a martial arts teacher. You had to know exactly how far to push your students, how much mental and physical discomfort you wanted them to experience, because that led to growth. But then on the other side, how much support and caring you had to demonstrate, which led to them recognizing that you understand them. So it is a fine balance. You have to push, you have to pull, you have to prod, you have to coach. But I think what's really important here, Sam, is to recognize that it's your responsibility. It's not the employee's responsibility. You can't sit back and complain and moan and groan about the quality of your employees unless you are leading, not only by example, but by demonstrably showing that you care and you're willing to help.
Spot on, Neil. But there is such a thing as the right balance. So let's try to share with you some frameworks. Number one is you got to know your employees. You got to know who you're talking to. Everybody's different. Everybody has different reactions. So if somebody's super sensitive, then you might want to be sensitive. If somebody can take it, then you might want to be a little bit more aggressive. Okay. So tailor your approach depending on the person. Number two, know the context, you know, the timing and what subject matter you're pushing on. Well, if there's something that's super urgent, that's super important, okay, you might want to be a little bit more urgent. But something that maybe it's not as important, that could be done or whatever, okay, maybe ease off a little bit, because we already have five other priorities that we got going. We can't make 10 things priorities. So have the context in mind. And number three, it all comes down to clear communication, right? The foundation of all relationships is good, clear communication. If you don't explain why you need this done or how this fits into the bigger picture, Neil, people are not going to have enough of a reason to get that stuff done. But if you start communicating this better, hey, this needs to be done by Tuesday because X, and this is why it's important for us.
Yeah.
When you communicate like this very clearly and very calmly, people will get the clue and will understand the urgency. But if you just instead you say, I need this done. Okay, Mr. Mean Guy, who just hands me a bunch of stuff every couple of days and it just goes away and comes back. like, bro, it doesn't work that way. So know your employees, have the context in mind, and communicate very clearly and patiently and gently.
Yeah, you know, one of the things you said about your parent analogy, I also think also in terms of family law. I used to advise my clients all the time, really try and understand where to fight your battles. Not everything is a crisis. Okay, so deal with the important stuff and use, you know, the non-important things as teaching moments and to areas where you can expand your communication skills.
All right. So let me summarize it for you. So if you've been dealing with any of these decisions, I'll just give you one framework. So when it comes to spending your money on marketing, just follow the traffic ladder formula. It works amazing for any practice type. And join our program because we help you with all these things that we shared with you when it comes to your marketing. And if you just go to mylegalacademy.com, book a call to speak to us, I promise you it'll be the best call of your life. And it'll be one of the most pivotal moments in your life that you get a handle of your law firm. Number two, when it comes to hiring, use some intangibles and tangibles. When it comes to tangibles, ask for proof. When it comes to intangibles, look at all those intangible little factors that we talked about. And look to hire doers and not talkers. Number three, the best way to get performance from your team is to incentivize. There is a right way to be able to incentivize, learn those principles that we shared with you, and start implementing those things for your team. Number four, have sustainable work-life balance. Know your priorities. Know what's sustainable for you. And don't let, you know, have your own rules when it comes to this. And number five, know when to be aggressive and passive with your employees. Know your employees, who you're talking to, know the context, and communicate very clearly. Neil, this has been amazing. We have a bunch of other amazing, valuable episodes lined up for you. If you can, please take a moment to please share this episode with one person that you know that will get value from this. They'll appreciate it. We'll start some dialogue between you and them and just say, hey, I thought of you. I wanted to share this with you. And that'll be not only good for them, it'll be good for you, and it'll be good for us. Win all across the board. Neil, I appreciate you, and we'll see you in the next episode.
And you, Sam. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to The Law Entrepreneur. If you found value in the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. And don't forget to share the episode with a friend. It could help transform their life. To get access to a treasure trove of exclusive free resources for lawyers, go to joinlawyerclub.com. Again, that's joinlawyerclub.com. We'll see you on the next episode.